from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. Good morning to you. My name is Jay Moran. And today we're going to be highlighting a conference that we're going to be talking about considerably. We're actually going to be talking with different panelists as we get ready for the first annual Sankofa Conference Buffalo. It's coming up on February 28th from 10 until 4 at Performing Arts here in the city of Buffalo. One of those panelists is a familiar guest on our program, and that is Dr. LeGarrette King from the Center for K-12 Black History and Racial Literacy Education at the University of Buffalo. Dr. King, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
Always great to speak with you because we are able to cover so many topics. But, you know, first and foremost, this conference, I guess in a lot of ways, obviously you'd be a natural person to reach out to have as a panelist on this conference, but talk about your interest and what, you know, attracted you to become a panelist.
Yeah. So, you know, the conference, Sankofa Conference, I'm always kind of, you know, attracted to kind of our approach to Sankofa. And, you know, for the listeners that, you know, don't know, Sankofa is, you know, means that, you know, we reach to the past to help us have a brighter future, right? So always kind of looking towards history and seeing how history can help us read the present and push for a good, you know, future. So, but yeah, the, you know, organizer, Emmanuel Kulu, is a, you know, good friend of mine. He has spoken at our conference on many occasions. And so he reached out and said, hey, would you like to be involved? And after I heard all the great speakers and panelists that would be there, I could not say no. So I'm really excited about the conference coming up on the 28th.
Yeah, when it comes to conferences like that, it's always interesting. And, you know, I know each year, of course, your center puts together a pretty ambitious conference as well, bringing in guests from across the country and to share their information as well. Is the effort that you have to put together a conference like this, or like the Sankofa Conference, I mean, what are the expectations when you put together that type of conference?
Wow. I'm sure those expectations vary, you know, mm-hmm. based on the person. And I really, I can relate, you know, to mm-hmm. the, you know, people who are planning the conference, as you want to make something that is educational, right? You know, something that's transformational, right? You know, somewhere where people can come and, you know, network and meet new people and just, you know, come together, right? And particularly since it's situated around, you know, Black history, I'm sure, you know, folks just want to come out and just have a really good time and just learn as much as they can. So to my understanding, it's probably one of the, you know, first in the area, you know, that, you know, has this kind of diverse, you know, panel and presenters, you know, here. So I'm really looking forward to it. I know the planners are as well.
So, and you also intimated this before we went on the air that this is the 100th, February will be the 100th Black History Month.
Yeah. So, Black History Month originally started as Negro History Week in 1926,
okay.
Right? So this is like 100 years of Negro History Week / Black History Month. Black History Month was official in 1976, so what, 50 years?
Sure.
You know, for that as well. So there's a lot of events that are happening this year and probably throughout February that kind of connects to this 100 year. As you know, it is extremely difficult to have an institution last 100 years.
Right.
Right. Particularly a institution focused on Black history, as we've seen, you know, recently and in the past, that Black history comes under attack. Right. Black history is a polarizing topic for many different people. Sometimes I don't understand why,
right. No.
But it has. So it is outstanding and that, you know, Black History Month has been able to last this long, right? And it kind of connects to what the conference is all about. It's all about bringing everyone together, and it's a grassroots effort, right? So Black History Month has never been something that's top down. It's always been grassroots, and that's how it has survived, you know, all these years. And I'm looking forward for, you know, conference kind of to be connected. And I'm sure the conference was created based on this outstanding anniversary.
So yeah, it's interesting when you're talking about Black History Month, or as you said, Negro History Week. It's interesting that it's gone from a week to a month. But and the idea that for some it's polarizing, which is confusing, and we don't necessarily have to get into that. But just the idea that it is not only an institution that has survived, but it's expanded. And I'm wondering what, as you have understand it as a historian, but also just as an individual growing up in the United States, you know, why it has been able to not only survive, but also, in my viewpoint, thrive.
So, you know, Negro History Week and Black History Month has a very interesting history. So most people credit Carter G. Woodson as the founder of Negro History Week. But that second week of February has always connected to the Black community, right? So one of the reasons why February was selected, not because it was the shortest month, like a lot of people like to joke, right?
Oh,
but because in Black communities, ever since the late 19th century, they celebrated Frederick Douglass, right? Mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass was someone who was have said to be born on February 14th, right?
Okay.
And then also an important person within, you know, Black communities back in the day was Abraham Lincoln, right? And Abraham Lincoln's birthday, I believe, is February 16th or something like that, right? So those two important people within Black communities from the 19th century, Black communities used to celebrate during that time anyway, right? And then February has always been American History Month as well, right? Most people don't know that. So Woodson, when he was trying to figure out when we should celebrate it, he was like, well, the Black community already celebrates these two birthdays, so why don't we have Negro History Week on that second week of February, right? And then throughout the time, Black History Month just expanded because communities, you know, black communities from the 50s and 60s was like, a week is not that long. We need to expand it for a month. And then, you know, Black communities pressured President Ford, I believe, to, you know, expand it to make it official, right, for a whole month in February for it to be Black History Month. So you see that, you know, Black communities have always had that agency, right, that always had this desire to really pinpoint, right, what Black History Month and, you know, learn our histories and talk about those histories, you know, during February, which has always been a celebratory month for it. But one thing people always miss within the aspects of Black History Month, because, of course, this is the United States and we do things wrong, right? But Black History Month was never intended to be the only time that we celebrated Black history. Black History Month was supposed to be, let's say, like an assessment or a test, right, for all the Black history that was taught throughout the year. So Black history was essentially supposed to be the celebratory month of Black History Month when Woodson first kind of thought about the concepts of a Negro History Week, which was done in Black colleges before, but it was like Negro literature and history week or whatever the case may be. And Woodson's fraternity, which is Omega Phi Psi, used to kind of hold that. And Woodson said, I could do a better job, you know, than you all. And that's when 1926 and nuclear history, we kind of blossomed.
And I have to give him credit, Charles Gilbert, our producer, just whispered in my ear, you're close in your estimate about Lincoln. It's February 12th.
February 12th.
But that definitely tracks, like you said, the second week of February for sure. So, you know, like you said, the month itself, though, has taken on lots of different meanings and different evolutions. But where for you and your students, where does it sit right now? Where does that month sit for you?
Wow.
Like you said, I mean, you know, history happens all the time. Mm-hmm. It should be taught all the time, but maybe isn't.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, I, you know, revere February as, you know, the space where we really can delve into particular topics around, you know, Black histories, right? Understanding that most people lack, you know, the knowledge around Black history. I do see Black history as a space where we can really put it to the forefront, right? I enjoy like going to various different programs, right? Schools all over the country have these assemblies and community events always have these particular aspects, you know, around Black history. So really for me, it's a very joyous occasion. It's my busiest month in terms of, you know, working or whatever, you know, kind of like, you know, I guess the first of the year as an accountant's, you know, busiest time right. getting ready for taxes or whatever. So February is very busy for me. And I use this time really to learn about a lot of different stuff that I don't know, right? You know, so so at the center where we are having two Black History Nerd sessions for the month. Usually we have one, you know, per month, but we have the president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, which is the organization that Carter G. Woodson founded in 1916. And so, you know, we'll have her kind of explain the nuances of Black History Month and celebrate the 100-year, you know, anniversary as well. But yeah, for me, I just love February, right? And love how all these various different communities come and, you know, really just kind of, you know, celebrate us in all different types of manners.
Our guest this morning on What's Next is Dr. LeGarrette King from UB's Center for K-12 Black History and Racial Literacy Education. Dr. King just mentioned how much he likes February, and he already a busy February. He's going to be a panelist on the first annual Sankofa Conference coming up on February 28th at Performing Arts. We'll repeat that and mention that a little bit later on if you have an interest in it as well. And I'm fascinated to hear you say that you're always learning something about it, which I guess stands to reason. You have an interest in history. You know, there's no real limit when we go to history and what we can delve into and how much we can learn. At the same time, I'm interested about how the availability of Black history has perhaps changed.
Oh, yes.
I'm wondering, you know, what you can share about that. You know, where we're at right now, because, you know, there's, you know, not a lot, some parts of the history isn't necessarily written history, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the documentation that probably maybe that did exist, perhaps does not exist for a lot of different reasons. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can share some perspective on that.
Yeah. So, you know, as everyone, well, I don't know if everyone knows, but people may be familiar with, you know, the new administration and their what I would call an assault on, you know, the a diversity education, which most people consider Black history falling under, you know, through various different executive orders. And many places have volunteered, right, to not, you know, celebrate, you know, Black History Month. There has been book bans in schools and in public libraries, and a lot of Black history themed books have been quote unquote banned or on a watch list. Recently, the museum or the National Museum of African American History and Culture, I I believe there has been, under the direction of the, you know, president has, you know, said move some different, you know, themes from, you know, the museum, and maybe featuring other, you know, themes in the museum. So we see, you know, these, you know, kind of interruptions, right, you know, towards Black history. But what I've seen, particularly the last few years, has been more community engagement, right, within Black history, you know, Black history and Black history education, right? Understanding that, you know what, like, our children may not receive, right, a lot of Black history in schools, which has already not happened, right, right, within schools. So I see an uptick on more community events versus, you know, school-wide or official, you know, aspects of Black history. So, yeah, you know, communities have really stepped up. But what's happening now in our country in terms of Black history, I just would like to kind of ask people in power, like, what is the problem?
Right.
Right. You know, and if the discourses that I hear in our literature and, you know, throughout the news is saying that it's making people feel bad, or if it's too violent, or if it's too sad, and we need to uplift stories of, you know, agency and, you know, joy and all that stuff. And that's fair, but it's not necessarily one of those things where you have to pick one or the other, right? We can have a complete, you know, Black history education without leaving things out or making things up.
Let's talk about the oral tradition when mm-hmm. it comes to Black history. From where I sit, it seems, especially American Black history, mm-hmm. obviously, to me, it seems like it's a key to what we understand today. How do you see it?
I would say that I learned more Black history from family members than I have when I went to school, you know, pre, like, getting my PhD, right? You know, of course, the oral tradition in various different African countries has always been, you know, elevated. But it's interesting how we don't necessarily consider the oral tradition in Black American homes, right? So when your, you know, grandmother or, you know, your great aunt starts telling stories, right, about the family, they are talking about history, right? And, you know, a lot of times we don't connect it, right? So I remember Isabella Wilkinson had a book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which speaks of the Great Migration, you know, post-20th century, the first half of the 20th century, where millions of African Americans moved from, you know, the southern states and moved up north in Chicago, New York City, Milwaukee, Detroit, all these particular places for better economic opportunities or better social opportunities, and to escape kind of the racism there, right? But then, and listen to my great-grandfather, who stayed in East Texas, Henderson, Texas, and accumulated 100 acres of land, right? We have that story, right? Which is not a history that we learn in schools about those who stayed and what they did when they stayed and the land and why they stayed, right? And those are very valuable history lessons, right? And that's why I tell people all the time that not only even listen to your senior family members, but make videos, mm-hmm. you know, of them speaking about your family history, which is connected, right, to kind of this larger narrative that, you know, we learn about it. But yes, the oral tradition is extremely important. And I think as we move more into kind of a technological society, right, or AI society, that is extremely important for us to really chronicle that history so we can have that legacy on file.
You always intrigue me with these. One answer sparks a lot of other questions, but Henderson, Texas.
Yes.
So it sounds like you've made sure that you understand what's happened and coming out of Henderson, Texas. What can you share with us? What was it? What do we understand how your family, you know, move through those times?
So, you know, what's interesting? It's, you know, my great grandfather, he had elementary education. I think his parents or his grandparents were enslaved in Rust County, Texas, right? Very little education, worked on, he was a sharecropper. His wife passed early on, but he had 8 kids, right? You know, facing racism, facing all those things, but he decided to, you know, hey, work the land, right? And I remember my dad, who used to work at the farm a lot of times, would say, yeah, we had to kill what we ate. So, you know, we had pigs and hogs and all on this 100 acres of land that he accumulated. I still don't know how he accumulated all the 100 right. acres of land, because I think he was a sharecropper, he was a janitor, and a single father, and all that stuff, and was able to, you know, do all that. But Henderson is a, I don't know too much about Henderson in terms of the official history of Henderson, but just visiting there, you know, throughout my life, it's a real slow, you know, Texas town, right? In East Texas, right? You know, close to Longview, Texas, and Paris, Texas, and you know, that's a joke with friends back in the day when I said, "Hey, I went to Paris," and, "Oh, you went to Paris?" Like Paris, Texas, right? Lots of land, and you know, kids learned you know, farming techniques. But then, as we, you know, began to start getting a lot of, you know, education, my father's generation, a lot of people moved out, right? And you know, now since my generation, we're getting older now. We're in our 40s and 50s now, and you know, what's going to happen to our land and our space in Henderson, Texas? Because a lot of us don't live there anymore.
But it's still part of the family.
Yes, yes, it is.
Oh, very good. It's still a farmland or not?
It is. It is. My, you know, cousin called me a few summers ago and said, "Hey, you know, we need help clearing out, you know, the land." I said, "Okay, cool. I may make a trip out there." He said, "Yeah, and you need to bring your AK-47 because we have wild hogs on the land and they will eat you." And I was like, "Oh, okay, that's okay. I won't go down there anymore because I don't consider myself a city boy, but I'm not a, you know,
right.
you know, a gun, you know, guy, AK-47 shooting wild hogs." But yeah, it's I believe we're down to 68 acres of land. I'm not sure where that 40 acres went, but you know, we're down to 60, but it's still in the family, and Davis is our family name. So
hey, if I'm not mistaken, if I understand how those wild hogs work, they might clear a lot of land for you. Yes. They eat just about everything in sight.
Yes, and have a lot of babies. So
it'd
be a little dangerous down there.
Maybe better stay on campus for that.
So, you know, for those who believe in the Second Amendment, right? You know, you know, our family believes in that. So
yeah, when you live in the rural areas, it becomes a whole different kind of a sense for sure. You know, it is great. So, are those stories then defined like other people though? Also, whether you know, obviously a lot in common in the sense that at one time, you know. Much of most Black Americans were rural people, right?
Yes,
and then, of
yes.
course, like you were talking about the Great Migration that has changed. But are those stories that you find yourself exchanging with colleagues and things along those lines?
Yes, because those are the real that's the real history, right? You know, and that's with any, you know, body's history. It's all about coming from those who lived through that era. Because many stories make up one history, and typically we only learn one quote unquote narrative, right? But when you sit and talk with, you know, people about their lives and their childhoods, then you can kind of connect the dots between, oh, this is the national story, and this is how this person fits within the national story. And sometimes they fit perfectly in that national story, right? Like, okay, yeah, you moved to Chicago and, you know, you lived here and, you know, you worked at the, you know, the steel mill, just like we learned in our schools. And then sometimes those stories are just totally different, right? Like, so for instance, like, I love talking to, you know, people who grew up during the Brown versus Board of Education era, right? And if we learn our national history about Brown, we typically learn it in a positive, you know, way, right? It's like, yo, you know, this Supreme Court, you know, case kind of brought it together, you know, segregation wasn't good and we brought these people together. But when you begin to start talking to people who lived during that era and experience, you know, that history, they will have a different story, right? So, you know, I hear a lot of times where, you know, my father would talk about, yeah, man, we used to fight, you know, we used to fight all the time and we didn't take any mess, right? And you hear people, you know, say that, you know what, my teachers did not want to teach me, right? And in many ways, we lost a whole generation of children, black children, you know, in particular, that didn't get really good education because we had teachers who did not believe that these black kids belonged in these schools, right? And then on top of that, probably the most egregious thing that we haven't, you know, caught up yet is that the loss of, you know, a whole cadre of black teachers and black educators, right? Because, of course, integration meant integrating into white society and not black society. So what happened to all those black schools, right? Those black schools, you know, were closed or they became the alternative centers, right? What happened to all those black teachers and black administrators? They either lost their jobs or they were demoted, right? And we haven't caught up since, right? I believe now, in terms of nationally, maybe 7% of teachers are black, right? But back then, you know, being an educator was a, you know, middle class, you know, occupation and well respected, and they lived close to the schools. I think they had houses that they built for those, you know, teachers then. But, you know, we lost all that because of the Brown decision, right? So really sitting down and really listening, you know, to people tell those particular stories orally kind of gives you a different perspective from the national stories that we tell.
Really appreciate that part of the perspective, Dr. King. It's one of the reasons why I love sitting across from you, because we always seem to find our way into some really interesting aspects of history as well. Let's take a little break here. We'll come back and talk a little bit more. Dr. LeGarrette King with us this morning. He is one of the panelists coming up for the first annual Sankofa Conference on February 28th. Actually, we're going to be hearing more conversation during What's Next about the conference and some of the other folks that are going to be part of the panel, and also main speaker as well. Those are just some of the things coming up on What's Next. Right now, we're going to take a short break. Back with more with Dr. LeGarrette King. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, brings you trusted, local journalism every day. Our reporters are in your communities covering the stories that shape Western New York and Southern Ontario. The issues, people, and decisions that matter. Add national perspective from the BBC and Here and Now, and you're connected to the larger world without losing sight of home. Stay informed with reporting that you can trust on BTPM NPR.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love. Listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at the Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. My name is Jay Moran. Very pleased to be joined by Dr. LeGarrette King from the University of Buffalo, one of the panelists coming up on the first annual Sankofa Conference Buffalo. That's February 28th, 10 until 4 at Performing Arts here in the city of Buffalo. Dr. King, love getting into these conversations and kind of connecting the dots. And one of the things that's always interesting to get into is connecting history to the present. Mm-hmm. And not only its importance, but how to go about it. And I bet you've, I wonder if you've evolved in your approach to things as you've become a scholar, and of course has been, in depth of your own conference that you put together with secondary educators talking about Black history. How about that? Connecting history with present day.
So history is a blueprint, right? I tell people all the time that history is probably one of the most important things that can predict, the future and help us understand the present, right? So for most people out there, it's like, what's one of the first things your doctor asks you about, your medical history,
right?
Your family history, because they would like to kind of predict, right? Like what may happen based on your history, right? People without credit, they ask for your credit history, right? To kind of see, okay, well, these are the behaviors that this person has, and we can predict whether or not, this person would pay their bills or whatever the case may be, right? And that's the same thing with kind of our society, right? So when people kind of look at the present and they're like, whoa, wait a minute, this sounds like, right, that this person may be this, or they look at it and like, wait a minute, this policy was used, right, in the 19 blah, 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 and this would happen when we did that, right? So, for me, particularly whenever I get into a new endeavor, I'm humble enough to know that I'm not the first person that's done this, right? So now, I go and I ask people who've done the things that I've did, or I look at history and say, huh, how did other people who built organizations, how did they deal with these particular aspects, right? So when we talk about like Black history and how it can kind of help us in the present, we can say, okay, all right, this is what happened. Now, things may change, right? Particularly when, people like to talk about kind of social justice approaches, right? And most people kind of point to the 1960s civil rights era, right? Now, some younger people may point out the Black Lives Matter era, right? I think the Black Lives Matter era was purposeful of not really attaining a lot of things from the 1960s social justice movements, right, from the civil rights movement, because they felt that those particular movements did not necessarily connect to the contemporary circumstances in which they belong to, right?
Okay.
So, so in effect, they were like, wait a minute, these people were very discriminatory towards women, very discriminatory towards the LGBTQIA, people. We're going to be a little bit more progressive than that particular aspect. Marching, we don't need to march anymore. We need to, because of social media, we have this particular approach, right? So, but then... people kind of look back and say, shouldn't you have taken some of those particular lessons from the 60s and connected to the, 2010s or whatever the case may be, right? And sometimes that stuff works, sometimes it doesn't, but we always kind of look towards the past to kind of guide us here in the present, because nothing is new under the sun.
Nothing new under the sun. I like the way that sounds, for sure. So let's talk maybe a little about present day and connect it to history. So, we kind of skimmed across some of the current federal policies and maybe the pushback against DEI. Mm-hmm. Do you have comparable stories from history that you say, I'm maybe seeing a little of this right now? I'm just wondering, both maybe from a negative standpoint and maybe even from an optimistic standpoint.
Yeah.
What do you say?
So I can point to like how Black history has been, connected in classrooms, right? There's always, surprisingly, in the past, a lot of school districts were not against Black history for Black students. They were against Black history for white students, right? In those spaces. So you would see evidence of, so like if anybody can go to their, county library or, some type of county government aspect, and they can kind of look at school board records, right? And you'll see what school boards, did during those particular times based on the school board minutes, right? So you know, in the South particularly, you see a lot of school boards that, you know, did around the time Negro History Week, you know, came out, and they were real favorable of their Negro schools having Black History Month programs or Black History courses, and, you know, but they were not favorable for those courses with white students, you know, in them, right? And on top of that, they were never connected to things that are histories that were critical of the United States, or history or historical people who did not fit the progressive narrative. Right?
Okay.
So it was always like Jackie Robinson, yes. Nat Turner, no. Right. You know, Dilmore Vesey, no. Right. You know, but Booker T. Washington, yes. Right. So throughout history, right, you've seen like how the evolution of Black history in schools have evolved. Right. So you would have these. So you would see these courses, particularly in the 2000s. You see these school districts say, yes, we can have Black history courses. Right. But, you know, we can't learn about these particular people, or we have to teach about the civil rights movement as this, right? So popular in the civil rights movement is like, yes, Martin Luther King Jr., yes, Black Panthers, no, right? Or if we are going to teach the Black Panthers in a certain type of way, which this is going to be the 60th anniversary of the Black Panthers in 2026. They started in 1966, 2026. But we will teach them as something akin to the KKK, right? You know, so you continue to see this now, even as we are kind of involved in, you know, Black history now, is some school districts are saying, okay, we do have this executive order, but we can't have Black history, but we can only have this kind of Black history, right? We can't have this critical social justice, woke, you know, type of history. We have to have this more progressive, friendly type of Black history. And, you know, those are the things that we've been battling against for the past 50 years.
The 60th anniversary of the Black Panther movement, Charles Gilbert, we got to put that down on the list of things to get into. I know from his perspective, there's a personal connection there. So yeah, we'll
have a few Black History Nerd sessions in the second half of the year. Focus on the Black Panther Party. So
yeah, it's interesting how I've been fortunate enough to get to know a lot of people in the last couple of years through this show, and the connection, family connections, to the Black Panther movement.
Well, I'll learn more about that as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that for sure. I digress, as I often do here. I'm sorry about that. I'm wondering, as you're talking, though, and the idea that, you know, like you said, oh, for the most part, if you want to teach Black history to Black students, that's fine. Not necessarily, in some cases, to white students. Do you think that is led to, or has helped to, or has kept the gap of racial harmony, for lack of a better term, has that added to that idea that, you know, well, we don't need that history, that if people understood their histories better, maybe we'd be in a better place right now?
I do believe that, right? History is the first. History is about identity, right? So it's the first time we learn about ourselves, right? So that's why those with small children, you know, out there, that's why your children ask a lot of questions. Mommy and daddy, where did you meet? Grandpa, was my mother bad? You know, and all those particular things, because they're trying to understand themselves through their history. It's also, you know, a way to learn about people who are othered from you, right? People who are different from you. And the way that you understand them historically is connected to how you understand them in the present, right? So if you believe that, you know, immigrants are these bad people, right? Then anybody can say anything to you in the present, and you believe that because that's your historical perspective around, you know, about those particular people.
Right.
So when you don't learn about 50% of the population, right? And if you believe different stories or stereotypes, and you've never understood, you know, their history, or even understand people in the present, then yeah, there's a chance for you to be demeaning towards them or see them as not as human as you are.
Hmm. How about for you and your thirst for history as the years have gone? Obviously, if you've committed your career to it, but was there a point for you, or what was it, an experience for you when you were a younger person that kind of sparked all that for you?
Great question. You know what? I've always been interested in history, right. Like ever since a young boy. And I remember this like it was yesterday. Like, you know, I'm from, you know, Louisiana. So I went to elementary school in the 80s, 1980s for all the young people, and, which doesn't seem like a long time for me. But it doesn't seem like a long time, but I remember drastically listening to the teacher, and we were talking about you know, the founding fathers and plantation economy, Louisiana plantation economy. And I remember when the teacher said the phrase, yeah, but the plantation owners treated their slaves like family. Mm-hmm. They loved them, they, you know, and all this other stuff. And I remember sitting there like, this doesn't make any sense, right? Like, I didn't know the language that I know now, but I just remember thinking to myself, it doesn't make any sense that how are they family, right? When they quote unquote own them, mm-hmm. right? And then I said, and then I think I asked the question. I was like, well, could they go somewhere and just leave or whatever the case may be? She's like, no, you know, they couldn't do that or whatever. But they were very kind to their slaves, right? And that there kind of said, wait a minute, I need to learn more about, you know, this. Because it just didn't make any sense. Because I was thinking as a child, like, well, if someone owned me, I would not want to be owned.
Right.
And I'm thinking like, well, maybe they didn't feel that way too. So I remember my mom buying us these encyclopedias. Britannica or something like that?
Britannica?
Yeah, Britannica. like these big sets of encyclopedias. And I just start pulling them out and just started reading. You know, about this particular history. I'm like, hey, what are you doing? I was like, I'm learning about slavery or something like that. She was like, thought it was weird, but she was proud of me for reading.
Sure.
So that's where it started. And, you know, from then, I've always been in like honors history classes, and me and the teacher would have these, you know, conversations just about, you know, history. And that's where I think it started.
Do you have a hero in that regard, that, you know, someone who has been, like, you know, like you said, picked up on those questions early on and has helped to lead the way?
Yeah. So I'll say this. I had this teacher, Miss Pendergrass, who was my American history honors teacher at Baker High School. Shout out to Baker. Hmm. But in terms of like just histories, I have three favorite histories.
Okay.
It just fascinates me. Number one, my favorite history is the Harlem Renaissance. I think I like the artistic, you know, aspects of it. My second favorite history is the Haitian Revolution. Mainly because, which I always thought was weird, because in the United States, we love the underdog story. And right. I always thought the Haitians who fought the British, the Spanish, and the French, that was outstanding for this small little country of, you know, enslaved individuals to fight these large, powerful countries. And I'm like, wow, we need to make a movie out of that. But, you know, I have my own thoughts of why we never had a big blockbuster Haitian Revolution that I won't say on radio.
I'm reading between the lines. I think I'm doing okay.
And, oh, man, my third. Booker T. Washington fascinates me as a historical figure.
Sure.
Right? I think he has had some bad press, but then also when I read stuff about him or read about him and the things he's done, his beliefs, I said, okay, I understand why people didn't like him back in the day, right? So those are kind of the histories that you can talk to me for hours about those types of things: Harlem Renaissance, Haitian Revolution, Booker T. Washington, I would just be fascinated about that.
Hmm. We are talking with Dr. LeGarrette King this morning on What's Next. He is already one of the panelists coming up at the annual, or at the first ever, I should call it, Sankofa Conference Buffalo. It's taking place on February 28th, 10 until 4, at Performing Arts here in Buffalo as well. How about this community? I mean, you're relatively new to the community. I think maybe I first interviewed you 5 or 6 years ago. It was about then.
I bet it's just 22.
Okay, 22. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we're coming up on 4 years right around. I think it was wintertime, actually, when I first talked to you. I think I remember hearing the Louisiana and you were talking about, about Buffalo winters for the first time. What's been your impression of this community, its approach to history, and specifically, of course, Black history? What has stood out to you? And maybe is there a trend that you can share with us that's maybe a little hopeful?
Yeah, it's a lot of hunger here, right, for histories, right? You know, Leah from the African American Culture Center and the Michigan Street corridor, and from you know, Kulu, and you know, his approach to the Sankofa Conference. It's a lot of hunger, and it's a lot of first. I like the you know, the corridor, that was one of the first, you know, places I went to, which now I'm a board member, you know, on, and just the love that, you know, those individuals have, you know, towards just preserving, you know, the Black, you know, history and culture, you know, within an area is definitely. So based on kind of where I've been in the past, I think Buffalo has a real strong, you know, community connection to its history, and would like to kind of, you know, push it forward. One thing that I guess I could, you know, say, which hasn't been from trying, right, but I think all of us need to kind of get together and everything, but everyone's so busy,
right,
and you know, trying to do what's right for their particular, you know, organizations, that you know it's very hard. But it is a very strong community here, you know, Black history community, which, you know, I'm proud to be a part of now.
How I mean, you're a board member now of the you know, the
Michigan Street
corridor. Mm-hmm. Is it, do you find it, it's drawing that interest from outside? I mean, that's been part of it. I mean, obviously, a big part of it is to celebrate what's here. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always a big part of history. There's also been that concept that this is going to be something that's going to draw more attention from outside. What do you sense?
Yeah, I think we have plans, you know, for it to be a little bit more connection. But you know, we do have a lot of, you know, interest and, mm-hmm. you know, visitors that come through now. You know, we are kind of building up some things which are being completed. But I think the goal is to have it as a, you know, a place, a destination place.
Sure.
You know, for a lot of people coming through. So I'm very confident that, you know, what happened. We have some great partners, and you know, we have a really good leader, you know, to kind of push us through. So I think that will happen very soon.
Well, that's good to hear for sure. And most certainly encouraging. You know, we kind of glossed over this early on, but you brought up the book banning.
Oh, yes.
Let's talk about books a little bit. I love talking about books, and I will certainly would be interested to hear maybe your thoughts about some of the books that maybe have been banned that maybe were books of yours, or I'm just kind of curious. I'd love to hear from people who are well-read and educated that they can share with us about some of these topics.
Yeah, so my wife and I talk about this a lot, and she's more the expert on the literacy side. She studies, you know, Black history and Afro-Caribbean, African diaspora, literature books, children's books, and everything like that. But certain books, you know, that, you know, center, you know, about Black civil rights and I remember there's one book, I think, written by Bell Hooks, Happy to Be Nappy, which kind of talks about, you know, Black hair and being proud of those particular things. And there's just all different types of books that aren't what I would consider, quote unquote, controversy.
Right.
Right. Controversial. But just helping people understand Black culture. And I think that's really important, right? Recently, there was, you know, something shared on social media. It was a Black child at school, and I believe it was the child's birthday. And so the teacher, you know, had the class sing Happy Birthday, the regular Happy Birthday song. And after the regular Happy Birthday song, the teacher said, "Hey, would you like to have a funny birthday song? And the child was like, sure, you know. Hmm. And then it was this birthday song from Madagascar, the cartoon.
Sure.
Right? It was like, sure. Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. You live in a zoo, you smell like a monkey, and you look like one too, right? So, you know, there it's like, okay, wait a minute.
Hmm.
Like, I can't believe this teacher, right, sung this. And you could see the child kind of deflating a little bit. I don't know what was going on in the child's mind, but you could see a smile kind of come down, like, whoa, I don't know what this is, but this doesn't feel right thing. So those types of children's books are helpful for teachers and helpful for his classmates, because there were some classmates that were laughing a little bit, you know, based on it, because, you know, it's an innocent song from a cartoon. But if you don't know the history of human zoos, black people and the connection stereotypes to monkeys and the smelling aspect of it is very inappropriate. And those types of books are easy, right, for us to really understand black culture, understand black history, understand black people holistically. So when we ban those types of books, which we push away that type of knowledge for you know, people to really understand. And then plus it's literature.
Right.
Right. And when did we start banning books here in the US, right? You know, so
yeah, the bluest, you know, eyes, the one that kind of,
yeah, the bluest eyes and
to my mind, yeah.
And all those particular books and which are stories and narratives and you know, things that, you know, enhance our, you know, brain capacities. And so, you know, it's interesting.
So a Sankofa conference is coming up on February 28th. It'll be at the end of Black History Month. Black History Month is upon us. We've talked about it in a little bit, but maybe a little, I don't want to necessarily use the term call to action, but I can't come up with a better term. But just, you know, from a historian, someone who is living in history. And you know, I'm sure as you meet new people, you find curiosities, small and large. You know, what about that? What are the opportunities? What would you encourage people to perhaps do in Black History Month that maybe make it better, not for them and their understanding?
Yeah, like I say all the time, like, you know, you know, check your community's websites and newspapers and, you know, radio stations and see what's out there for you to, you know, learn, you know, different, you know, different community events are happening all over. If you have children, you know, check out their Black History Month programs at their schools, if they have them. And, you know, to be honest with you, just continue to learn, right? You know, purchase books and look at documentaries and just, you know, continue to learn about Black history and culture, because in terms of those who, quote unquote, really believe in history, right, we don't know our history until we learn all the other diverse perspectives of history, right? You know, Baldwin, James Baldwin, in 1963 had this talk that is called a talk to teachers, right? And is very applicable to today. And when he noted that, you know, white people are mad, right? And one of the reasons why they're mad, mad at Black history, is because, you know, they don't know their own history, because they don't know Black history, so they're mad. But if they really understood history in its totality, then they wouldn't be so mad, right? And of course, I'm paraphrasing for those James Baldwin scholars out there that's going to say, "Oh, he doesn't know anything," right? But that's the kind of the gist of you know, Baldwin's kind of understandings of all of that. So it's just all about, you know, so as we enter kind of our 250 year celebration of the Declaration of Independence, right? You know, learn about those, you know, Black fathers and Black founding fathers and Black founding mothers, which will aid into us understanding, you know, the founding era, right? But, you know, hey, what do I know?
I'll tell you what you know is you've been giving me assignments throughout this this session, Dr. King, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate always the great perspective and you know, the chance to have nice conversations about issues that aren't, like you said before, in some ways have been pushed to the side. Mm-hmm. And I think I appreciate you and what you and your center have done to try to make sure that they don't get pushed to the side.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate Absolutely. It. And we're looking forward to hearing more about the Sankofa conference. You got expectations for it, or you're gonna roll in and just see what happens? What do you got?
I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful conference. I'm looking forward to meeting all the other panelists and meeting all the people that will attend. I'm hoping to learn a whole bunch and just have a good time. It's going to be the end of February and the end of my busy month. So
yes.
I'm going to really be excited about participating.
And you can hear Dr. King, as a matter of fact, at the Sankofa Conference Buffalo. It's coming up on February 28th, 10 until 4 at Performing Arts here in the city of Buffalo. Dr. LeGarrette King leads the Center for K through 12 History and Black History and Racial Literacy Education at the University of Buffalo. Repeat guest here on What's Next, and we appreciate your time here, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.